Hey, what is going on, everybody, and welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Vlad Sedler, and we're recording this in the afternoon, West Coast time, on Thursday, June the 12th, right before the weekend of baseball action. We are on the cusp of week 13 of the fantasy baseball season, and this week I am joined by two wonderful colleagues of mine here at FTN Fantasy. I will introduce them one at a time. The first guy is a veteran NFBC player, high stakes aficionado, and he writes our weekly Waiver Watch article. This probably already gives it away because it's called Whitestone's Waiver Watch. He's at Telestar 7. Todd Whitestone, what's going on, Todd?
Not too much, Vlad. Good to talk to you.
Next guest is also a colleague here at FTN. He's been doing the prospect vault for us for years and does a lot of our daily fantasy betting stuff all over the place. Does a college basketball guru, I know, and college football. I know you helped me there last year on some stuff when I knew absolutely nobody. The only problem is he's a San Francisco Giants fan, at the SF Giants guy, Jake Kuchek. Jake, what's going on, man?
Hey, man. Good to be on here. Thanks for having me on.
And I, of course, I say that jokingly. My first fandom. I'm a Dodger fan through and through. I would like for them to win, you know, again this year. And but listen, during the season, game to game, like, first of all, I don't hate teams. I don't hate the Giants, you know, Giants fans, anything like that. Padres fans, I don't know, maybe sometimes. but you know, rivalry, it's fantasy first, and then, you know, call me backwards guy, but that's just kind of how I am.
Yeah, I appreciate the brotherly rivalry, and we'll keep it to that, and we're actually kind of keeping pace with you, especially if we don't blow this game to the Rockies that's going on right now.
Yeah, I hope they don't, because I have bird tongue going.
Yeah, by the way, I hadn't seen the line. I saw after three innings he was doing pretty well. Is it still going well for him?
He did six innings, 300 runs, so it was decent enough, sure.
Okay. By the way, I have to ask you, Justin Verlander, is he on track, Jake, to be back this week? Who is he going to displace in that rotation?
Is he on track to be back is a question of more art than science, because at that age, those injuries, you know, they can have setbacks at any time. The assumption, I think, from my perspective, is that Kyle Harrison would go back to the bullpen, even though he was fairly effective in the limited non-Coors Field starts that he was given. But who knows? There's been a ton of roster shakeup on the offensive side. We might see some roster shakeup in the rotation or in the bullpen. Or maybe they'll say, you know what, Justin, you can come back, but you're going to come back in the bullpen and we're going to leave Kyle Harrison in the rotation. Could be any number of things.
Sure.
Let me ask you, Todd, if you've got Kyle, I don't know if you have Kyle Harrison on any 15
teamers. I do.
Yeah, it's a tough position to be in because, I think we were in it this last week. I think most of us realized that Justin Verlander probably wasn't coming back right away. Kyle Harrison was going to get a start, might get two this week. Mm-hmm. And it just, a guy of that talent level, especially when we spend a lot of fab money on him. And of course, there's that sunk cost that we don't want to fall for. But also, dropping him prematurely always seems rough. And just thinking about, what is he, 41-year-old guy in Verlander that we think is just going to hold the rotation spot for the rest of the year, it's kind of foolish, right? So in most cases, it would kind of make sense to hold on to Harrison, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think Harrison will be a starter in the second half of the year. Whether this middle patch works out for him, I don't know. But I think the hardest thing, Vlad, is, you know, when they push him back and forth between bullpen and starting, I think that's difficult for a young pitcher to negotiate. So I hope that doesn't last too long, because I think it'll throw him off. I'd rather see him throwing at least three or four innings in the games that he's in. You know, that would be helpful.
So we are we have a special setup today for this episode where we're not looking into the upcoming week of Fab or any weekend matchups or anything or any news or things like that, unless it pops up along the way. We're going to talk more about prospects, ones that are specifically NFBC worthy. And we're going to talk about that from the angle of Fab, because a lot of us are spending a lot of money on free agents. And And we've been doing it for years, right? It's just like since NFBC started, some of us are more disciplined than others, and some of us do hit on those prospects when it's somebody special. For the most part, we just see a lot of failure, or we see delayed gratification. Josh Lowe is one example I always think of, a guy that just come up and busted a couple seasons ago in his first turn, and then came back, was a 30th round pick, and was really I hate to use the term league winner, but he was a very strong part of very good rosters. I mean, just stolen bases, home runs, everything. And there are always examples like that. And it's almost even worse when we're in on a guy, right? It could be like a Zach Veen, right? We bombed, spending $100-some on him earlier this season in April. who's to say that, it could be later this season, comes up and just gets hot and you get a good stretch of it. But this game is so hard. Fantasy baseball is hard as it is. We're tracking this stuff day by day as things are changing with rotations, batting orders, lineups, promotions, demotions. So it's hard as it is. So just kind of throwing out all that out in the big sphere. Just some overall thoughts on that before we dive into some of the details.
You go ahead, Jake. You can take that one first, perhaps. I mean, I can give the fab viewpoint, but maybe knowing the prospects is a good place to start.
Yeah, it's been, I think, overall kind of an underwhelming year for the prospect crop. Everyone expected – well, let me back up from that. The expectations for prospects are way too high generally when they first come up. And I think that anchors around what Ronald Acuña did when he first came up, and he crushed it. And he was like, he was hitting home runs left and right. You couldn't get him out. And it makes people forget that when Mike Trout came up, he was terrible. And when Buster Posey came up even further back than that, he was also terrible. And anytime you have what is eventually an all-world Hall of Fame type talent, it's entirely possible that they're going to struggle with their first taste of major league pitching. Mm-hmm. Because there is no preparation for major league pitching. And so I think, you want that immediate gratification because you just spent the fab and like, I paid my money and now I want my return. And it doesn't work like that. Nick Kurtz doesn't know that you spent $300 of fab for him. He's just out there trying to hit 100 mile an hour fastballs, the likes of which he hasn't seen with that kind of movement or, incredible threat of a breaking ball taking away from his ability to lock in on that fastball. And so it's a really difficult thing to remember how difficult it is for these guys to do what they want to do. And that the fab purchase of whatever prospects you're going after are going to be, the returns are going to be paid over time. You're not going to get that immediate dividend the way that we so often want to. And even with Caglione, who's up and like he's had ridiculous exit velocities, which was his calling card in the minor leagues, but he hasn't homered yet. So people are upset. And it's been a pretty small sample, but we're also not very patient with these guys. We want our immediate returns. And so I think it's really important to remember that. Now, that said, even in that context, so far, this has been particularly disappointing prospect class. And I think that will turn around. I think that we will see some cream rise to the crop. The guys who showed how good they were in the minor leagues won't stay bad forever, won't stay underwhelming forever. And, even Kurtz, who I think people are somewhat disappointed by, he was going on kind of a tear before he got hurt. And he showed, okay, maybe he kind of figured it out and tweaked something in his approach to now we are going to see that like 30 to 35 home run power show itself. And I think there's probably three or four guys that's going to happen for too. We have to be patient. We don't want to drop those guys. And we have to understand that their returns, even though we bought them in May or June, their returns might come in July, August, or even September. And we got to let that play out.
Yeah, I agree 100%. The only thing I'll add is that from a main event 15-team NFBC context, you know, the prospects that come up that are largely not owned are some of the only upside free agents that you're going to have a chance to get. So it does change the landscape when you're talking about a 15 team league that, hey, this guy may not produce right away, but he's got a chance to do something much more than, you know, the run of the mill Adam Frazier, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, people on the waiver wire. But I have to mention also that in 12 team leagues, which I do play also, you know, people are paying big dollars for these guys, even though the waiver wire has a lot more people. So I think Jake is right. I think expectations are too high. But, you know, it's exciting. And every once in a while, it just often enough, it does hit that it keeps people coming back. If it was a 98% fail rate, you wouldn't see the bids. But it's better than that. And people get excited by the possibility of fixing a stolen base or a home run problem that they have on their teams.
Yeah, it is also unpredictable. And we have to remember that these are, you know, these are humans, right? These are humans, yep, the top of their game, that are constantly adjusting. They're going through personal things and, you know, in the locker room and adjustments on the mound, injuries, all these things. And it's just hard to know. I mean, think back to those folks that added Jordan Beck for, you know, $50, just like on the week when it was like Nick Kurtz and Agustin Ramirez week, and everybody's focus was there, and folks that were able to slide by a Jordan Beck probably didn't know they were going to get this type of return. You know, a guy that is a leadoff man and hitting well, producing, albeit on a really bad team. And you have to stay steady. You cannot be too invested, I think, emotionally into these players, the highs and lows. They are all going to slump. Was there anything more predictable than Agustin Ramirez going into an ice cold slump after being red hot, mm-hmm, you know, coming right out of the minors? I mean, this is the part of the game that we have to accept. There are constant ebbs and flows. And when you throw in the pitcher's aspect of it, there are injuries. There are, are they up just for a little bit, you know, with the rotation? Not only do we not know what the managers are going to do, a lot of times the managers don't know what they're going to do yet. Look what's going on in Milwaukee right now. Logan Henderson, not in the rotation. We'd love to see him up there. He's been excellent when he was. Aaron Civale's asking for a trade now. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think just to add to that a little bit, the Chandler Simpson thing, from a fantasy only perspective, it was like, hey, we got exactly what we wanted. And so we spent the money on him. He did what he was supposed to. Everything was going good. And then they just like took the candy away from us again. And so we have to remember that the baseball managers and front offices aren't managing fantasy teams. And if Chandler Simpson is so bad on defense that it outweighs how good he is at stealing bases, we no longer get to benefit from Chandler Simpson. And so there's another guy I think we'll talk about later that might have that same issue, but we'll get into that in a little bit.
On Chandler Simpson, is that really all it was? Was it the defense? Because it's just, it was weird. I think it was really unexpected for a lot of people. I know Jake Mangum was coming back. You've got, you know, 28, 29-year-old prospects. I mean, I wouldn't call them prospects, but rookies, right, with him and Cameron Mizner up, and everybody's healthy there in the outfield. But I mean, last week in Fab, I told folks to in the column, just go ahead and pick him up. 12, 15 teamers, if you can afford the stash and you need the stolen bases, I mean, this is a no-brainer in fantasy. Hopefully he'll be up soon, but even then, it's worth the wait, because the, you know, the average stolen bases you get out of a week is just, you know, it's insane. It's, you know, 3-4 times the average player.
Yeah, the from what I had read, it was the defense was pretty bad. Obviously, they, you know, had some folks come back and get healthy, but they wanted him to go down and work on it for a bit. He hit kind of better than I was expecting. You know, with everyone always kind of called him, you know, the next Billy Hamilton, but like but like he actually hit for a decent average, and a lot of it was, you know, his speed driven. Like he hit the ball the way you're supposed to if what you can mainly do is run, and that's on the ground, and he would bunt for hits, and he was getting on base and stealing bases and scoring runs, and apparently just giving away too many of them back on the defensive side. It was my read on it.
Yeah, I think it was a difficult from a team context point of view for fantasy teams because he was providing no power. So we did end up dropping him in one league where we had a roster crunch anyway, because we had moved up pretty well into the stolen base ranks, and then we needed the spot. And, you know, I think to have him, even if he came back, which was questionable how quickly he's going to come back, you know, I think it was not going to be that helpful to our team the way it stood right then. So you have to make these tough choices because there's only a 7-man bench in the NFBC. But I do agree that teams with stolen base problems could pick him up and hope that he comes back sooner than expected.
Wanted to ask you, Todd, we are going to talk about some of these prospects. We're going to dive into them. We're going to look at them from a FAB perspective. But real quick, as far as main event budgets, like you talk about this every week in your article, you're tracking all this data. How are we so far on spending as main event players on average in comparison to previous years? I know you've got this data tracked several years.
Yeah. So right now there's $363 left for the average team out of 1,000, which is a little less than usual, less than last year. Last year's spending was like maybe 10% slower. Each year is sort of its own thing, but we're sort of in line with what usually happens. That's not way far off from the average. But I think one thing I did want to mention for people, whether you're in an NFBC league or something else, is that one quick way to see where you are is to look at all the teams in your league for FAB, add them up and divide by the number of teams instead of just going by the average, which I produce for the main event, because your league may be spending faster or slower than usual. So, but right now, I think, since we're at 363 left, I think the average bids are going to start to come down pretty sharply over the next 2 or 3 weeks. There's a few big names coming up, and maybe Jake can comment on Yuri Perez, for example, who's going to be this week. I think he's going to get a lot of activity. But I think except for the few big names, I think the average winning bid is going to be well below 100, maybe 50, 40, 30, even for the second tier guys. And I think people have to do that because you don't want to have, you know, $12 left for September. Even if you're in contention, that's not going to be enough.
Todd, I know you do some of your teams on your own. You partner some with James Anderson, a good friend, running the RotoWire prospect, just a brilliant guy. But what is your strategy on conditional bids, especially at this point in the season, as far as, you know, once you're just happy to just get somebody, are you usually just throwing in a bunch of dollar bids, like after you get past the fifth guy, or are you going a couple of dollars more? Because I feel like there's a lot of money to be saved where when, you know, even in a competitive league, you know, you can still maybe get some guys for cheap, but if you just go a dollar, if you really like them, you might miss them. But at the same time, if you're just sort of aimlessly throwing 8, 12 on your fourth, fifth conditional bids, a lot of times that ends up being just extra money you're leaving on the table.
That's very true, very true. And so James and I go through the dollar amounts pretty carefully. And if we don't think there's much difference at all, Vlad, between the last 4 or 5 guys, but we need a shortstop, for example, we will put them all at one. But every once in a while, there is a third or fourth option that we think is better than the rest of the guys. So we would put the 7 or 8 on that, for example. But I do go through it with James because we don't want to spend even, it sounds silly, but $5 or $6, $7 that you don't have to spend is something that you want to avoid. So we try to conserve as much as possible. And then, you know, if we want to spend one big $200 bid, it's kind of unusual for us. But if we do, we want to have that money available.
Jake, I know you play in a variety of NFBC leagues every year. I join you guys for the industry. It's not an industry league. But the SCARF league. It's the Southern California version, and we all get together in person, and we draft, and we have fun. And a lot of guys like Jeff Erickson and other friends are in that league. And so it's a pretty competitive league. And then you also do some OCs, and you did one live in Vegas at a higher dollar amount. So through your experience in NFBC, what are some of the differences that you've seen in those sort of like the standalone, like a SCARF? And though it's not a standalone, I know there's an overall competition there. And then the OCs, where sometimes you got really, really great players. You got people that just kind of threw in an entry, don't know what FAB is. And then this large overall pool, like any strategy differences when you're bidding in these leagues?
Yeah, it's interesting. In SCARF in particular, and I'm sure other regional leagues are like this too. Everyone is extremely sharp. There's no one that is not paying attention. There's no one that does not put a lot of thought into their FAB bids. And so the obvious result of that is that the FAB process is extremely competitive, and everyone is kind of looking at all the same stuff, and you're not going to get away with a cheapie. And so you've got to keep people honest. You've got to stay on it. You've got to look at how much everybody has left. It is frankly, even though it's not one of the more expensive leagues that I'm in, it's the one that I probably put the most research into my FAB process in, because I got to get guys. Like, I can't just get outbid because everyone is pretty sharp. At least in the OCs that I still am fortunate to be competitive in, there is a wider range of FAB strategies. There's a couple of them where, like, there's guys who have less than $50 left in the FAB. And so there's, correlation with who's competitive in the league still and who has FAB left. And it's a little bit easier, to predict who's going to do what. Whereas in SCARF, everybody's going to do everything all the time. And I have to bid as though, there are, 14 other competing owners, even if not everybody has a chance at first place. And so it is interesting to see the differences in the parallels, and that it is not necessarily correlated to the buy-in, how competitive the leagues are.
A quick question for you, Todd, about draft strategy. Let's say every year we know that there are these players that are bumped up because they are just coming off a career season. And so there's a new premium to be paid for these guys. Do you have any specific strategy with this? Are these type of players that you avoid entirely? Do you pick and choose on them? Like, how are people supposed to do this? Because if you really look at it, Nolan Jones was the great example from two seasons ago. And most people were telling you, hey, don't buy in at ADP 70 because that hot month of September, it's just not going to work. And granted, he got hurt. That's a different story. But if we're looking at some of these, quote unquote busts, I wouldn't even call them that yet, right? Because it's still early June. It's only a third of the season done. But is Wyatt Langford really a bust? He's on pace for 30-30. He's got a 50% hard hit rate. Granted, he's hitting 226. He just homered, Thursday as we're recording. Right. Lawrence Butler's 10-10 right now, and he hasn't really gotten hot. Won't he be okay? Brenton Doyle's been kind of hurt. McLean's been out of baseball for a year. Vientos hasn't been himself. Like, these are the sort of the busts now, but they really aren't, right? And we can look at this 2 months from now and be like, no, it's okay. But what's sort of that like delineation? Like, what's the Nolan Jones for you that where I'm avoiding, or when you can decide, like, I'm buying in on this guy that just had a career year?
Okay. So two answers to your question, Vlad. One is we usually do an approach where we decide which guys we want to target. And sometimes they're more important, sometimes they're less important, but there's a limited number of them. It's not, James and I got into trouble very early in our partnership where we saw a couple of guys falling and we said, oh, we weren't in on this guy, but he's way below his ADP. We're gonna go for him. And it turned out very badly. So we're better off if we're sticking with the guys we really like. And that usually is a pretty, not an incredibly small minority, but maybe, a quarter to a third of the player pool, not a huge amount of the player pool. In terms of the guys you mentioned, Langford, for example, I didn't get him very much, but I think his future is very strong. I just looked at his sort of Statcast numbers, and he's got a 13% barrel rate and a 50% hard hit rate. So I think it's going to turn around for him. I'm also very high on Butler, who I do have quite a bit, to be honest. And some of the guys, I think if they have a great June or July, as you're implying, we're going to forget all about the April, May problems that they had. So I don't think there's any magic formula. I would just say, for me, it works to sort of pare down the player pool and not be trying to get everybody and just say, okay, I'm in on everything. You're going to miss a few guys, but you're better off sticking with the guys you're confident in.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, and also from a prospect perspective here, Jake, a lot of times we're, how do you put it? Like it's like the heat of the moment. So like right now we're looking at, profiles of, okay, let me rephrase. We're looking for like, what is the pro? Is there some magic formula for us to figure out if it's going to work out? Like, for example, Jackson Merrill, second round pick, maybe not the best example, but like there was a period of time where James Wood, a third rounder, fourth rounder in 15 teamers, right before the season started, I forgot, maybe he got dinged up, but like, I feel like we were all a little worried about James Wood. And so far he's been amazing, right? But then a month and a half from now, maybe he gets hurt or he's slumping for a while. And then Brenton Doyle heats up, or maybe he's not the best example. Langford heats up or something, but like there really is no magic formula, right? For some of these players to figure out, how they're going to turn out as prospects.
Yeah, there's not an, I think the James Woods is a good example of it going well. Jackson Churio is an interesting case because he started really slow last year. Like there was like talk of like, oh, maybe they should actually send him back down for a little bit. And then, when the weather heated up and, he kind of finally put it together, like I was talking about earlier, figured out what adjustments he needed to make to hit major league pitching. He was phenomenal. Like and ended up being, a second round pick, in some cases a first round pick, in an FBC. And he's again, like he's been okay, but he hasn't been the level that we would have expected given what he did towards the middle and end of last year. But if you look at the timing, like he did this exact same thing last year. And so like he's on a curve that started at a higher place, but he's still on kind of the same yield curve, right? If you look at it from the perspective of the return that you get over time. And so I think like we anchor very much on what has happened so far and what happens early in the season. And if a guy, has a great start to the year, but then slumps in July, people like kind of forget about that more. And that doesn't make any sense to me because the stats count just as much, right? And if not more so, because you might be competitive in July. And if a guy slumps right when you're trying to make that push from third to second or second to first, that hurts a lot, right? I think it was like Xander Bogaerts that had an amazing April a couple of years ago and then was terrible in June, and everyone was going, man, if he had his June in April, we would have been super worried about Xander Bogaerts. While there's no formula, we kind of have to analyze patterns of, maybe there are just some guys that need a little bit of time to get in their rhythm. And if they are still, walking at the same rate as typical and still striking out at the same rate as typical and hitting the ball just as hard and pulling the ball just as much, maybe it just, the ball needs to fall sometimes. And so absent any massive outliers on underlying metrics and kind of Statcast type metrics, I tend to be of the mind that I'm going to ride people out and let them perform to the degree that we originally expected them to. And plus, like, you're not ever going to drop Jackson Trujillo, right? Like, there's too much cost in that. He's too valuable of a player. He's got too much potential production that even if you're wrong, you're going to hang on to a guy like that. Whereas with a guy like Matt McClain, he was very good to almost elite for a finite period of time, and has been downright terrible all year. And so I don't know that he's a drop yet. Maybe in some leagues he would be. But if he doesn't turn it around soon, he didn't have that initial prospect pedigree, and he doesn't have that larger body of work where we can say, okay, at this point of the year, we're going to expect him to turn it on. He might just be bad now. And as much as I don't want to say it, I'm a little bit worried about that same thing with Yuri Perez, with a pitcher coming back, you know, from a TJ and maybe not looking right. In a similar vein, Spencer Strider has very much not been Spencer Strider. And there's, especially with pitchers, I'm going to be a lot quicker to go, hey, maybe we don't have the guy that we had pre-injury. So when it is a results only based change, I'm going to give a lot more leeway than when there is, you know, some fundamental change to what is happening on the underlying metrics, or potentially the injury changed the composition of what the athlete's able to do.
And I wanted us to dig into some of these guys here in a bit, see if, you know, who might be called up soon, who could be fantasy worthy, guys that we really need to keep an eye out for, specifically for NFBC leagues, both 15 teamers and 12 teamers. So we'll talk about those guys in a bit. Before we do, just really a quick overview on how FAB has been sort of spent, distributed on average for some of these top players. Literally just talking about the prospects here. You've got your three heavy hitters to start, right? It's Nick Kurtz, it's Jack Caglione. Both of those guys were going in the 280s on average in 15 teamers, a little bit lower than that in 12 teamers. And then, of course, Agustin Ramirez for the Marlins, catcher guy in the Jazz trade. We'll say it, you'll hear that for the 5 millionth time on a podcast. That's who Jazz was traded for. So those three, you know, those three guys were the three that went for over 250. Looking at the rest of the list, I mean, listen, there's some hits here and there, but I'll run through these guys. And then if anyone stands out to you, if you want to talk about them, Todd, Chandler Simpson's average price was 132. Is that right? They really go for that low?
Yeah.
Chandler Simpson, Ronnie Mauricio went for 122 this past week. If he didn't have those hot few days, I think it would have been closer to 80. Right. Yeah. You know, Zach Veen's average was 122. Marcello Meyer was 111. Jordan Beck, 95. Caleb Durbin, 77. Kyle Teal went lower than I thought at 75. Those are the hitters. And then we're just talking about pitchers, you know, guys over $50 in main events on average who are prospects. On the pitcher side, it's really not that big of a list. It's like Kate Horton of the Cubs for 120, right. Chase Dolander a bust for about 100, Gunnar Hoglund, you know, for about 70, and then the I guess Daniel Palencia is a rookie. I
guess so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One thing to remember, Vlad, is that the prices tend to be lower than you'd expect for the players that were able to be picked up before their call-up. So Chandler Simpson, I seem to remember, he was drafted on a few teams. He was sitting on waivers. People thought he was going to come up, and so they added him at lower rate numbers. And then even though the bidding was heavy for him when he did get the call, I think it averaged out to a lower amount. And that can work the same way for anybody that was drafted and dropped. They're able to be picked up by teams before their wide call up. So that does affect the average price somewhat. But yeah, I mean, if I think the rule that I would suggest to people is you have to be very careful about paying top dollar for the prospects, as Jake is sort of indicating, that whenever the wide call up is, when the dogs are released, you know, and everybody on the leagues that somebody's available knows they got to bid $200-$300 to get them, that's when you really run the risk of making a bad call. It could work out, yes, of course, but the thing is, if you can get a player or a player like that for half or a quarter of the price, that's the time to do it, not to do too many of the $250 to $275 bids, because you're cutting into your fab and you're just usually it puts such pressure on that player to perform for you that they have a really tough time measuring up.
Yeah, so I'll just kind of touch on that a little bit. There, for me, there's usually one guy per year that I'll know ahead of time. I'm saving my big fab splurge for that guy, and that's also a part of your draft strategy, right? Like if you are going into it knowing that at some point in probably June or July, you should have enough fab to, if you still want to be able to pick up a guy that has this skill set, you can build that in to what you're building when you're building it. And you better be right about getting him, because if you don't get him later, then you're missing whatever stats you were kind of hoping that he would bring you. Or if he doesn't perform, you're missing those stats, right? And so you better both get your guy and be right about your guy. And so for the last 2 years for me, last year it was James Wood, mm-hmm. and the year before it was Ellie De La Cruz. And both of those, frankly, have worked out pretty well. This year for me, it was Caglione. And I saved my fab as I thought I was supposed to. And I bid what I thought was a crazy bid, and I still lost. I was lucky enough to still have him in other non-fab leagues. And I actually, I drafted him in an OC and just kind of held on to him the whole time. So I still have some Caglione exposure, but in ones, where I was counting on him to, you know, be there for me because I was disciplined enough with my fab, to be able to put out a ridiculous bid. Turns out I got out ridiculous bidded by somebody else who had the same plan. And so you got to account for that too. And so for me, it's a bummer that I didn't get him in those leagues, but I also can now be a little bit more aggressive on guys that are available and maybe not the same, you know, big stud name brand, everybody knows him kind of prospects, but like a Mizorowski that, you know, yes, everyone is aware of, but also we're further along in the year this year and not everyone has the fab. And that's not really the guy I don't see there being, you know, $400 fab bids for Mizorowski mm-hmm. in the same way. And I might go 20% more than I otherwise would have, because I know that I didn't get Caglione and I didn't have my Caglione fab spend in those leagues that I wasn't able to get him.
Jake, so you're saying that he's going to stick in the rotation? That's what you believe here?
Mizorowski?
Yeah.
I think that there's a decent chance, and I was using him as an example of somebody that I could go after. I think there's a decent chance that he's one of the best five pitchers for the Brewers, and so is Logan Henderson. And
I was going to say that.
And they didn't keep him up. And so who knows what they're going to do, but again, like we said with the Chandler Simpson, we can only act on, you know, what is available to us, and if they are major leaguers, what the outcome will be. And I think it'll, with him in particular, I think it'll be favorable so long as they let him continue to be a starting pitcher.
One of the other things is sort of zigging when others are zagging, because a lot of times when someone gets tired of this prospect they've been holding or waiting on, like, for example, let's say Christian Campbell gets sent down to the minors. That's usually what I'm buying. I want to be against the market. Like, everybody's kind of down on him. Let me grab him a week ahead of time. You know, guy's hitting 230, probably going to stick around, but it's not guaranteed. He could go down for some more, you know, defensive work, positioning, you know, just get the bat right. It could happen, right? Cam Smith looks like he's been up, but think back to where his ADP landed before, you know, right during main event season. And that's one of the things that at the time I myself did not chase, and I recommended others to not chase. It wasn't just like, oh, I kind of know Cam Smith, I don't know much about him, and so I'm just being stubborn here. It was what I've done all this research and homework. Let me think about these guys that I'm passing up now just to like go chase with everybody for this rookie. No, I'm not doing that. It was actually part of the reason why, you know, I'm not trying to pat my own back, because Matt Shaw can still be great. He's got 7 steals in a limited time. He's in a great lineup, but I don't know. There was a point where a 280p, it was just too high of a price tag for me to pay. And so sometimes it's good to be, you know, waiting for somebody to get tired of these players, go ahead and pick them up once they've been dropped. And sometimes these guys come, they come in different sources, in different ways. They don't always have to be these giant splashes. I think Boston's Carlos Narvaez, the catcher there, is a great example of that. Chase Meadroth for the Chicago White Sox. He's been leading off, crazy walk rate, stolen bases. He's kind of got that, you know, profile. And then Narvaez has just kind of stolen the job there. And he's been really solid in the middle of a very good lineup, kind of taking, you know, the Bregman's position there, not by position on the field, but I mean like in the lineup. So you got guys like that. And, you know, sometimes it's all about the little wins, the cheap wins.
Definitely. And I think the key is, which guys are you stashing? When do you pick them up? How soon? You know, with a 7-man bench, it's pretty hard to do too many of them. But yeah, if you can get guys on the second time around, I've heard many people say, I think even you, Vlad, that's really a little better. You get them cheaper, and sometimes they're better prepared their second turn in the majors than they are the first time they come up.
Let me ask you something, Jake. Where did I go wrong with Jason Dominguez? I feel like I started to drink my own Kool-Aid, because he was one of my early gut feels when I first put out rankings in November, when I first started doing drafts. I ended up with him on a lot of teams, and I'm like, I am really, really feeling Jason Dominguez. And at some point later on in draft season, it was nothing to do with his performance. I started to sort of doubt myself, you know, dropped him a little bit down the rankings, stopped drafting him a little bit more, but I didn't think it was going to, I just thought he was just, the numbers spoke to me. This is a guy that with full-time at bats, really, no matter where he hits, I think he's going to be an 18 homer, 25 stolen base guy, and he's not going to kill you in the average. I didn't expect Trent Grisham to come up out of nowhere. We've seen splashes of it with the Dominguez, right? With like the 8 RBI, 7 RBI game, whatever it was. But like, man, it's just almost a lesson to myself. You know, you're paying high draft capital for, you know, a rookie. It's a prospect, but these things don't always come, you know, and just give you this lovely fantasy value right off the bat.
Yeah. I think the important thing to remember with him, especially with a guy like him, is most guys his age are in AA. And so he's already way ahead of the curve, the aging talent curve. Yes, he's had plenty of minor league reps, but he also hasn't had the chance to mature physically the way that a lot of his competition has. And so I think we still might get, maybe not exactly the Jason Dominguez that was promised, but I think we still might get a very good version of Jason Dominguez and better than the one that we have now. And when it clicks for him, it might be like a Jackson Trujillo situation where, you know, late July, early August, he makes some adjustment, something that the hitting coach said to him just vibes with what he's got going, and he's seeing the ball like a beach ball, and you're getting those massive games out of him that can kind of float your whole week. And so with a guy like that, where he's so young, there's still the possibility to figure it out to contrast him, I guess, with a guy who is in like his age 26 year and has already had 3 years of big league experience. It's going to be tougher for me to believe that guy's going to figure it out and turn it on out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So I think there's still hope yet, even though the performance is disappointing so far.
I agree. And, as a Yankee fan, I watched Jason Dominguez quite a bit. And the one problem he really does have is he's a switch hitter, for people that don't know. And as a right-handed batter, he really needs a lot of work. Against breaking pitches, he's just not the same hitter. And the pitchers, so it's almost like having a little better than a platoon bat. So right now, and I agree, I think he has the talent to overcome this and he can be a lot better. But right now, the way they're using him is they don't give him any at bats as a righty, which is understandable. So I think that's one thing to remember. So if you have him on your roster and you see a few lefties coming up for the Yankees, I would see if you can bench him because he's just not producing the same way.
And people will already see this, and this is a complete aside, but we were talking earlier about Birdsong, and no good, because the Rockies won the game. And shocker, somebody who does not give up runs, Randy Rodriguez, gave up runs, three unearned and one earned. So I think it was Orlando Arcia. That's baseball. Just beautiful. Just like the worst guy gets the best pitcher. You know, go figure. But I digress.
Thanks for bringing that up, Vlad. I appreciate that as a Giants fan. Just what I'd already forgotten about it, even though I saw it happen. And now we're talking about it.
My bad. Let's jump right here. Got some time left. I want to get into some of these players. Let me bunch a couple of these guys up, and then I'm going to ask the big ones here at the end. There's one player specifically who is, I don't want to put anyone in the Chandler Simpson, ballpark, but this is somebody whose name I've seen appear before, because he used to be a Padre. And now he's stealing bases like crazy in the minors, but this is somebody that you like, that you think might be up soon and producing from a fantasy perspective.
Yeah. So we're talking about Jacob Marcy. And if you are unfamiliar with Jacob Marcy, head on over to the FanGraphs page, because what I see is discount Chandler Simpson. But he will probably end up with some MPE because the Marlins do that to everyone. And he
multiplayer eligibility.
Sorry. Yes. Multi-position eligibility.
Even better.
And so unlike Chandler Simpson, who we can only deploy in the outfield, we may end up being able to play Jacob Marcy all over. And so I think of him as like a Chandler Simpson, John Birdie hybrid. He's got, I don't want to say he has some pop, because that's not correct, but he's not a complete zero in pop the way that Chandler Simpson is. He steals bases just as much, and even though he doesn't hit for average a whole lot, he also walks a lot. And so he has the ability to get on base. And so whether or not he'll be able to maintain that in a Marlins lineup that, frankly, pitchers should not be walking anyone against, that remains to be seen. But at least in the minor leagues, he's shown good plate discipline and the ability to get on base without hitting much over 200. And so if you have a guy who walks a lot and steals a lot of bases that just about no one is talking about or on, and let's, say that he gets called up on a Saturday or something. You might be able to get him for, you know, a cheap dollar or two type of bid on a Sunday, because he's not a guy that there's a lot of fanfare about. He doesn't do anything explosive other than steal bases. But if you are, if you have a roster composition where in particular, and either Chandler Simpson's not back yet, or you didn't get him, or you're just out on Chandler Simpson generally, this can be a really good alternative for cheap steals, cheap speed, that also can be deployed potentially in an MPE scenario. And overall is a guy that, you know, for this year, the rest of this year, but also beyond, I want to be paying attention to, because under the radar speed is hard to find, harder and harder to find. And he's a really good example of it. And he's stealing at an even higher rate than he has previously. So really interesting guy to be on the lookout for, that some, if not most of your competition might not be.
Yeah. 36 stolen bases so far in 60 games. He swiped 51 last year in about 600 plate appearances. Batting average, not so great, in the low 200s, but again, careful. Just, I think if you have, you know, I have a team where I've got Stephen Kwan and Victor Scott, or I've got Chandler, you know, you got to be careful. You have those guys, like two of those guys is not a scenario where you can add a Jacob Marcy. If you are sort of middle of the pack in stolen bases, you got strong power, or you're lower in the pack in stolen bases, it feels like he would be somebody that is a good add. Let me ask you, I'll bunch these guys together, even though I know it's not really fair to do so, of a Brady House of the Nationals, Bryce Eldridge, Bryson is his real first name, goes by Bryce, for the San Francisco, your San Francisco Giants, and the man, Samuel Basalo, not yet 21, but he's the youngest hitter in AAA, and he seems to be crushing it there. Before I ask you about those three, Jake, any of those three on your radar, or any anything, you know, I know you talked to James Todd, so you probably know, you know a little bit more about some of these guys. Any of these guys that stand out if they happen to be called up? Todd?
Yeah, I mean, James likes all three of them, to be honest. He was on Bryce Eldridge as a possible end of the bench guy in Draft Champions at the beginning of the year. And he's been very impressed with Basayo, I know. So, you know, I think they'll all three get a lot of interest when they're available. Jake probably knows better, but I think the Giants eventually are going to call up Eldridge. I just don't know if they're going to do it anytime really soon, but I do think he's going to be up in the middle of the summer.
Huge L for your host, by the way, who we worked on. Yeah, just confirming name pronunciations, and I obviously know the pronunciation of Samuel Basayo. Man, did I brutalize that. From somebody from Southern California, I should know better. Go ahead, Jake.
Yeah, okay, so I don't have to address that. We'll get right into the prospect talent instead. So the questions for them are different. So with House and with Eldridge, the questions for me is how quickly do I think that they will be able to adjust to major league pitching when they're brought up? Because they've both shown some alarming strikeout numbers when they jump a level. And so that happens with just about every young hitter. And then they make adjustments and then they'll be fine. That is a more pronounced thing in the major leagues, as we've seen with Kurtz and Gaglione. I don't have that question with Basayo. Basayo is amazing. He's been, you know, if I thought he were going to be up earlier in the season, he would have been the guy that I would have splurged on for Fab instead of Gaglione. Maybe he'll get that chance if they decide to bring him up. The question I have for Basayo is why bring him up? This is kind of a lost year for the Orioles. Things have gone terribly. One thought is, you know, just keep him down there, let him rake and destroy AAA pitching for, you know, the rest of the season and get another year of more time for you to not start his clock, his service time clock. The other thought is you got to still sell tickets in Baltimore. And you know, could they use a late July, early August injection of here's what the future looks like? And, you know, if they're still marginally in competition, could he help them? And I think another piece of it is they may not be so sure about what they have at first base anymore. I mean, it was a crowded logjam with Ryan Mountcastle and Kobe Mayo. And Ryan Mountcastle's hurt and Kobe Mayo has not lived up to expectations. They just sent down Heston Kjerstad, who also hasn't lived up to expectations. And so this behemoth of Orioles prospects that was, you know, potentially going to block Basayo from regular playing time, in addition to Adley Rutschman, of course, blocking his primary position, which is catcher, they don't have that same logjam anymore. And so would it be worth figuring out if they could move forward with Adley Rutschman as the main catcher and Basayo as their primary first baseman, who would also have the ability to DH and spell Adley Rutschman as catcher. And then we'd be looking at Basayo playing just about every day, but with catcher eligibility, which in Dynasty, that's a dream, right? And then for however many games we get of him this year, I think he'll be fantastic. But that's the bigger question for me with Basayo is not how will he be when he comes up. I think he'll be amazing, and he will be one of the ones that does not start slow in the major leagues, and he'll make adjustments very quickly. I think the question is how much of him will we actually be able to get, and that's what remains to be seen.
Wanted to ask a question about a rumor. So sometimes these things for me, just a little bit of common sense, but you just click on one article. It just seems like kind of clickbait. You don't really recognize the site. And it's talking about, tell me how realistic the situation is. It's talking about with the fact that the Orioles are just not looking good and things aren't looking positive for them, about Adley Rutschman potentially getting dealt somewhere or just given up on in, you know, for Basayo, but it's just so early for him. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Is there anything to that?
I wouldn't put any stock into that. In fact, I don't know where you found it. I don't want to speak badly of anyone, but whoever was writing that, I would view with a little bit less credibility. Cause I don't see that as something that even makes logical sense for their path forward. Yeah. Like Adley is young and is the, you know, the centerpiece of their team. And just because Basayo can also catch doesn't mean that you can't have the two of them coexist. Mm-hmm. And probably is better for both of them. You can get more days where Adley is DHing and Basayo is catching and vice versa. And Basayo can also play first. So it's not like you're limiting your DH slot to one guy when Adley's catching. Like I that wouldn't make any sense to me other than somebody who's looking at it from a pure pigeonhole perspective of these two guys both have like the C tag next to their name, and that doesn't work for me logically. But I think there's you don't have to use a lot of creativity to find solutions where both of them can coexist. And I think that would be the best move for Baltimore to do that and have both of them in the lineup as many days as is possible. And that means dual eligibility for Basayo, which I'm really excited about that because I do have a lot of dynasty shares of him.
Last couple things here. Let's start with you, Todd. Nick Kurtz versus Jack Caglione rest of the season. I have a feeling that like 80% of people ask this mm-hmm. question, fantasy, probably would go the Jack route. Are you on same? And we're just talking NFBC rest of the season, you know, player rater value, like the guy okay. that can hit, you know, whatever, 15 homers, 50 RBIs, 270.
Right. I would say it's pretty close to 50-50, but I would lean Kurtz just because I feel like he's got a little bit more lead time in terms of adjustments. And I think he's not quite getting the pressure put on him quite as much. So I would lean a little bit his way. I think they're both great players, and I don't think you can go wrong with a prospect, but I would lean Kurtz a little bit.
Let me ask you, Jake, am I overthinking it from my fantasy perspective of the ballparks that they're in? And the divisions that they're in, like the fact that the A's are going to continue to play in, you know, 100 degree heat, 90 plus in Sacramento, a lot of games this summer. And, you know, the other guy, Jack, is amazing, but a lot of those games are going to be, you know, in these, you know, the Tigers park, their own park, Kauffman, which is horrendous for hitters. Like, I understand his power is otherworldly, ball will travel everywhere, but how much of that factors into this train of thought for the rest of the season?
I don't think you're overthinking it at all. I think about it from much the same perspective. The reality is we don't know just how good that Sacramento park is going to play with major league hitters and also with, at least in Luis Severino's case, a park that is difficult for pitchers to pitch in, not necessarily because of the dimensions of the park, although those are also not good, but because of its configuration and an inability for a pitcher to go through their typical routine there. And we've seen offensive explosions there time and time again, the way that we frankly have not in Kansas City, partly because the Royals offense generally is fairly anemic, but also because that ballpark doesn't necessarily lend itself to offensive explosions or three-run homers being hit left and right. I think if you were to make an argument for Kurtz over Caglione rest of season, that's probably the strongest point of that argument that you can make, is that the 110 degree summer in Sacramento without a cloud in the sky and potentially some wind blowing out, and a team that is frankly pretty interesting on offense with guys who get on base, with specifically Jacob Wilson, but you know, other guys who have shown an ability to set the table. Obviously we know what Lawrence Butler can do when he's right. It's not a bad top half of the lineup, and the A's seem to be pretty committed to Nick Kurtz being a middle of the order bat. I think that, you know, Todd's 50-50. I might even be 60-40 in favor of Kurtz for specifically this rest of season, with the obvious caveat that Caglione's power could show up at any point. And if he shows up with some five homer weeks left and right, it's going to be pretty tough for Kurtz to keep up with that. So
one thing I would like to point out for people listening is that I know the Athletics have scheduled quite a few night games in the summer, which it should be cooler a little bit. If you see day games, I think that's when the effect is going to be the greatest. So I would just look at the schedule a little more carefully about whether it's a night game or a day game in terms of the schedule, because I think that's going to make a big difference in how far the ball goes.
By the way, Todd, you need to come out and visit us, and you will know what we're talking about here. So LA gets hot. Sacramento, right, in the middle of the valley, you have no idea. I'm talking like it's going to be 8 o'clock at night and it's still going to be 90 degrees. So it's like 90 versus 110, but it's
okay. Like, okay. It'll be a cool 90.
Yeah. Nice cool 90 with the winds blowing out. Todd, you've got the waiver watch coming out every week. Right. Anything specific that we're to kind of look forward to for these next few weeks? I mean, sort of many, many weeks to go here in the season.
Yeah. So I'm going to continue. I'm going to continue our tour around the 10 rotisserie categories. I got a few more to go there, and then maybe summarize what we've learned and how the categories are changing from year to year, and then follow the main event in the CLQ contest as we see who's going to rise to the top over the rest of the year. I think it's kind of fun to have an article that follows the contest instead of just talking about only the players and whether somebody should pick them up or not. So that's my angle, and I think it's always fun as it gets down to the wire to see who's leading and who's coming up the rankings.
I just have to say, not just because you're my colleague, but I think you're one of the most underrated. You have one of basically the most underrated column around in fantasy. It's very unique. Nobody does it. No way to replicate. And I actually see the data and all the research, which you are thankfully nice of you to share access with me. It's a lot of work that you do, so it's very much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you, Vlad.
Jake, you write that you have a big prospect vault article coming out next week. And just kind of wrapping things up with you. I appreciate you coming on as well. Any final thoughts? And then any thoughts on this everybody's guy of the week, Chase Burns? I know he's not just a guy of the week. I know he's a big pitching prospect. I know he just came up to AAA. But what are our thoughts and expectations for him for the rest of the year? And there's anything about the this week's prospect vault coming out?
Yeah, so spoiler alert, Chase Burns will be featured in the prospect vault as one of the few remaining prospects everyone knows that didn't get promoted in the last like 10 days. And rightfully so. The strikeouts are off the charts. The just overall poise that he's shown for his age at his level, all of it is positive. All of it is trending positive. The one caution that I would have is he's still going to pitch in Cincinnati, and that can be dangerous. As we saw with Hunter Green when he first came up, it can be a rough place to give up fly balls to big leaguers. And so if you get those seven strikeouts, but games with two or three solo home runs, that might happen, and that's still okay. But really lean into him when he gets those road starts against the Pirates and Rockies. I guess if you go to the Rockies road games, those aren't great either, but Marlins, let's use them instead. Get excited about him, but manage expectations with him and deploy him correctly. And that's when I see going pretty well.
That is Jake Kuchek at the SF Giants guy on your local social medias. Check out the Prospect Vault coming out next Tuesday featuring Chase Burns and many others. And if you play DFS over at FTN Fantasy, he is up in the Discords and crushing it over there with the DFS. And then, of course, my colleague, our other colleague, Todd Whitestone at Telestar7, a aficionado of the high stakes market and fab analysis and one of the best columns around. So Todd and Jake, thank you guys so much for coming on. And for Todd and Jake, for Jason Anthony, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.